All right, so I want to talk about memory management. Excuse me? I think this will. This worked really well last time. So you're certainly welcome to set it up. I was stunned. I took it home to do some audio processing on it so I could get out like the hum and some whine and the fan noise. Mm-hmm. And I was really, it's a dinky little microphone, right? I mean, there's nothing in that microphone. I'm amazed how well it worked. Okay. Before I do memory management, let me pop up a level from the discussion of IPC and let's look at actually how this gets used. Okay, so suppose I wanted to implement something like a file. And when I say like a file, I mean it's a linear sequence of bytes, and you can read and write it at whatever offset you like, and you have some reasonable expectation that this thing will get stored to the disk. Now, I'm not going to worry about the stored to the disk part. The question is really just what's the protocol for a file and how do you capture that? So, in POSIX, right, the relevant pieces of the protocol would be the read and write calls. And I'm not sure I've got the arguments in the right order, but it's not important. And following the sort of the object-ish rewriting, this is kind of like an elvish rewriting, only we don't have any elves, we would basically take that FD and turn it into a capability and move it to the front. Okay? And, right, the result that comes back is either a count or an error. Okay, and to reframe that in terms of an IPC system, what we'd actually have to do is basically take that count or error and reframe it as either an okay result in a count, or an exceptional result which takes the place of error note. A bit of trivia for you. This convention in Unix that I return a positive value typically for an okay result, a negative value for error, is horrible. And if you go through the Unix system calls, you'll discover there are system calls in which this convention cannot be correctly deployed. In particular, if you look at return value for mmap, you'll discover that mmap has no good way to signal an error because the return value from mmap, in principle, can be an arbitrary pointer in your address space. There's no good choice of an out-of-band value to say, go check it or no. Everything else returns -1 for it. You might wonder, how did -1 come to be the answer? Well, it turns out on the PP11 version of Unix, this is back somewhat, probably not before all of you were born. The practice coming out of the kernel was the way that the kernel signaled an error. There was a register that was the well-known register for the result code coming out of the kernel for the operation. And the question is, how does the library level know that it's an error? And the answer is, on the PP11, the kernel would set the carry bit on the way out. And then in the library stuff, it would say, if carry is set, move the value in that register to error note and return -1. Otherwise, return the value in the register. Okay? And that convention, which was basically designed to save a register on a machine that didn't have any registers to spare, right, became this overloaded return mechanism. And it's part of why error note is actually such a problem in multi-threaded POSIX codes, that in order to make that work, you need to make error note thread local storage. And thread local storage was a relatively late-breaking idea in Unix design. People fought it for years. Okay, so there's an aspect of the POSIX design, and well, the Unix design, that in my opinion was a mistake. And I think Ken would now agree that this was a mistake. That if you look at the internal data structures in Unix, right, you have the application level file descriptor, okay, and that indexes into an FD table, okay, and that thing actually it doesn't point to the thing you and I think of as a file, okay. It points to something called a struct file, which turns out to be misnamed. Okay, and the struct file, in turn, depending on which generation of Unix you're looking at, points to either an in-memory inode structure or an in-memory vnode structure. In every version of Unix that you can still get your hands on without going to the archives, is a vnode structure. Okay, the vnode structure. The in-memory vnode structure is the thing that internally represents an open file. So what is this struct file? The struct file is the place where the offset is stored, along with a few other tidbits. Okay. So when you do a write to a file, right, you assume you can do a bunch of writes and that it's understood that barring some weird multi-threading kind of a thing, right? If you do a sequence of writes that are not overlapped in some strange way, the expectation is that you're doing appending writes, or at least you're doing sequential writes in the file. Okay. Well, in order to do that, there's an offset that has to get updated somewhere, and that offset lives in the struct file. There are two aspects in which I believe this was a mistake. The first is that having this field buried in this data structure introduces a sequential dependency. Okay. You have to wait for the offset to get updated before you can do further sequential writes. The offset cannot update until a determination is made about whether an error has occurred. And this means that if I have a very large amount of data to write, I cannot simply fire off 64 writes, each at a different offset simultaneously. In order to do that, I have to appeal to some sort of asynchronous I/O interface, which corrects this issue, and that wasn't introduced until much, much later, in fact, very, very recently. But the other reason it's a design error is what happens on a fork. So after a fork, my new process also has an FD table, and it also has an FD, and these two entries point to the same struct file. Yes, I see a look of appalled shame. Not personal shame, but embarrassment on behalf of Dennis. Yeah, Ken. Yes, you're right to be embarrassed on behalf of Ken. This was a total mistake. Okay? And this is why you'll see a pattern in the more experienced Unix code server authors write that immediately after a fork, you'll see a loop of the form, for all the file descriptors that I still have open, use dupe 2 to dupe them back to the same location they're at already. This, of course, has no effect on the file numbers. The purpose of the dupe 2 is that the dupe causes this struct file to be actually Xeroxed. Okay? The effect of failing to do that is if the upper party does an operation on the file, the offset gets updated and the lower party now sees the offset. So there's this unintended sharing of structure. Now, the rationale was, overwhelmingly, the most common system call to see after a fork is exec. Okay, and exec, generally speaking, the pattern is you're going to close all the descriptors anyway. Okay, so look, why do the extra work to copy the data structures when I'm just going to drop them on the floor? The answer is because it's a lot less work than actually doing the workarounds to do this correctly in the case where you don't. This is one of these cases where you have an API that actively promotes error. I don't know
a test I can apply to an API if I, as a designer, to determine whether it promotes error. There are some heuristics, and one of them is either the API should entirely get things separated or it should entirely get things shared, but it shouldn't straddle the middle because then nobody understands what's going on. And there have been countless errors in Unix servers arising from this issue. So what's the fix? Well, I would propose that the right fix is that we should have simply specified the offset in the call. And this is, in fact, how most other operating systems do their I/O calls. Right? You're saying, write 70 bytes at this offset. There are devices that don't do offsets, notably serial devices. Serial devices, you can't exactly back them up. Yes, I know I've shown you 50 screens worth of stuff, but I take them all back. You can't do, there are non-random access streams in the world, right? But if you start from a stream-oriented model, this varying the offset thing actually isn't crazy. All right, so what's going to happen here is the offset and the length are, let me wave my hands and let's assert that we're going to do a 64-bit file system, at least that we'd like to do a 64-bit file system, and we don't want to change the protocol from 32-bit to 64-bit. We've done that once, it was really painful, let's not do that again. We're going to need 64 bits of payload for the offset. We're going to need 64 bits of payload for the length, or are we? Well, no, not in an IPC system, because in an IPC system, there's a bound on the amount of data you can send. And that bound is small, because we know from measurement it doesn't pay to make it very, very large. And we have other reasons to want to keep it small. Certainly small enough that it will fit comfortably in 32 bits. In fact, it would fit 16 bits with, well, it would almost fit 16 bits. Let's use 13 bits. If you're writing more than 4 gigabytes at a time, we have bigger problems than how long the length is. Trust me. Okay. I'm not opposed to doing 64 bits here. I'll explain why I'm going to 32. It would make sense, and in a certain way it would be more consistent to do 64 bits. I'll explain why I'm going to 32 in a minute. Okay, so now we've got a problem though. What I'm trying to walk through here is how you map this onto the low-level IPC system. That's what I'm actually trying to get to here, walking through this. So the problem is that in a microkernel-oriented system, this FD, in some sense, is not really a descriptor for a file, right? It's a descriptor for an endpoint, because this file is going to be implemented by some other process. So what's going to happen is now I know where that hum came from. So the really annoying thing from last week's recording was there were these periodic, varying, low-frequency hums. I don't know what they were. They were the air conditioning system. I'm pleased to report to you that it actually does work. All right. So, right, the client now holds a key that points into its table of endpoint descriptors, or descriptors, actually. And that endpoint descriptor points to a service. And now the question is, how do I know what file? Any thoughts? We touched on this last week. The analogy here is, this service is implementing a file system, and I now have to get to the particular file within the file system. Yeah.
Wouldn't the service know about a particular endpoint that the capability pointed to?
That's not an unreasonable assumption, but it turns out the answer is no. And the reason is that The service has to be listening on every endpoint it serves. And so if it has lots and lots of endpoints, and they're all simultaneously live, the server is now going to need a very, very large supply of threads. And concurrency is something that we sometimes have to succumb to but would like to avoid because it's complicated and error-prone. It's not a reason not to use it, it's a reason to use it judiciously. This is from the Guns Don't Kill People, People Kill People School of Multithreading. maybe not. All right, so how are we going to know what file we're talking about? Could I add something to the protocol? So let me expand on that proposal slightly to make it a little more concrete. Right? But if you think back to the way file systems are usually implemented, like usually the file has an on-disk file table called an IMAP table in Unix file systems, right? And the actual, at a certain level of abstraction, if you're trying to identify a file, it's just an index into that table. So we might extend that concept and say, well, the name of the file at a comparable level of abstraction will be this index. Okay? And so one thing we might do is extend the protocol, and we might say, I want to do a write operation, and in addition to telling you where and how much, I'll tell you which file number. And, server now knows which file we want to write. Will this work?
What about masquerading? There's no protection in here for generating somebody else's file and pretending to do that process.
Everybody see that?
Yeah.
This file number, right? You did say it, right, that we had to have a mechanism for determining whether this client was authorized to manipulate this file.
Right.
Okay. So we haven't specified that mechanism yet. So far, what we have is a proof by strong assertion. Right. We don't really know if there's any authorization here. So how might we deal with the authorization problem? What can we do? Let's look at requirements. Okay, so the requirements are that we need to get a file number, okay, and we need to authenticate. We need to authenticate that the activity on this file is authorized, if you prefer, because authenticate is actually a term of art. We need an authorization check. I prefer to reserve the term authenticate for humans introducing themselves to computers and keep it out of this part of the discussion.
So we talked about the idea of like protected payload last time and how the service gets specified and interface ID, which the client had privileged to. So it could generate at the like open request, it could generate a new interface ID and give that to the client.
Yes. Okay. So the proposal now is that file descriptor entry here in the client, okay, is going to consist of an endpoint and an interface ID, and then we're going to just take notice on the way through that
An interface here is not an interface in the sense of an ML interface or in the sense of a header file. An interface here has state potentially associated with it. It's an interface more in the Java sense. You speak to this interface, and there is at least implicitly an object behind it implementing the interface. Whereas in some systems, when we talk about interface, what we're talking about is the list of methods, but not any statement about your implements. And what we could do in the service is say, oh, well, that means that, in fact, I could use this interface ID as an object ID. And by burying it in the protected payload, okay, so basically I'm going to interpret this interface ID as the file number, and by burying it in the protected payload, what I know is the client was not in control of which file number I got. The only way I can receive an interface ID of any sort is by virtue of having previously stuck it in the capability myself. Because the party who fabricates these capabilities, the endpoint capabilities originally, is the service at the logical equivalent to the open call. Although there's a problem there, we'll come back to that. Now, if I'm the service, could I fabricate this capability, hand it to you, and you give it to somebody else, which wasn't quite what I intended? Yes. But at least there has to have been a path to you by which this transmission occurred. And it turns out, contrary to what a lot of people believe, that's the best constraint that's actually achievable. What else can we do? I mean, what we have here with the endpoint and file ID, I would characterize this as the classic capability-based solution. And anytime somebody says, well, we're going to do capability-based protection, the obvious question is, well, how would I do this with an access control list scheme? So how would we do this with an access control list scheme?
If your service maintains an access control list scheme, this process is allowed to write to this, that, and the other files, this process is allowed to write to these files, then it can just look at which endpoint things come in on, assuming each process has its own endpoint.
Okay, so we're going to maintain some kind of an ACL map that's a mapping from file numbers to ACL, right? Because we have to know which ACL we're checking. And now the idea is the client is going to go ahead and supply a forgeable file number. And our access check is going to be based on actually testing the file number in some sense, right?
Right.
Okay.
Did the endpoint the file number came from have the...
No, you're back in... not quite. You're back in the capability model. Okay. So let me turn this table into an array. Obviously, we wouldn't represent it that way, but let's convert this into pseudocode. So I'm going to imagine that I'm going to turn this ACL object just into some kind of a predicate procedure call that's going to do the actual ACL check. And I'm going to pass it some information about the caller and some information about the operation. Now I know the operation because I know what the opcode is, right? And I know what I'm being asked to do. And if I know the caller and the operation, that's what you use in an ACL check, and the answers are either yes or no. Okay. Now, what you said was we could use the endpoint ID. Yes, we could use the endpoint ID. At that point, we're actually stepping back to the capability model, and we're going to end up in a situation where we're going to have to allocate a different endpoint for each caller, for each caller identity. Okay.
And then we're going to get back into the multi-threading problem. So what else could I do? Maybe.
Some reliable way of getting information about the caller. It's got to be something that the caller can't afford. So, something at a higher level than the caller itself sending a message has to be providing some information.
Suppose the caller supplies a capability that encapsulates their credentials. Would that help? If you know an operating system currently running on probably every laptop you own that does this. This is the Windows NT model. If you actually dig into the Win32 library, you see that under the covers, right, the caller specifies a credential handler. The credential is the actual credential bits are protected by the DLS. So there's a descriptor type in the NT operating system that's a credential descriptor, and we pass that descriptor. Does that work?
Apparently not.
You've obviously taken question reading before. What's the problem? There's actually a really bad architectural problem.
I mean, just taking a stab at this, is there some, there have to be some policy for preventing this like sort of offline attack so that.
No, these credentials are protected state.
Okay. So
there's an offline attack in the sense that I could go after your password, but that's an authentication problem. And for this purpose, we're going to assume that the authentication is happening. If that failed, we're already in way deeper trouble than this. And it will fail, but it's a problem that we need to see how it's solved in a different place. What's the problem? How would you meet this? Imagine you're trying to read my files. What do you need?
Your credentials.
You need my credentials. Imagine you're the server. What do you know?
Do you pass all your credentials to any server that you use?
There's that problem, so you have to trust all the servers. That's all. That's actually quite a large problem. Okay. In fact, anybody who trusts servers in general is a moron. Yes, so in this design, we have the built-in property that any server is entitled to masquerade as me. In fact, that's why the credentials feature went into the operating system. They wanted servers to be recursively constructible out of components. It's a feature. If I'm a server, what's the intent of the design here? What are we actually trying to capture? In the actual controller's view of the world. Let me unpack some of this. If I'm the server and I get this message, what I know is somebody sent me your credentials, but I don't know if it was you. And I don't know if it was a process authorized to act on your behalf.
I know it's a process that got your credentials somehow.
And the OS, the protection of the credentials doesn't deal with that?
How can it? The only signal it has about authorization is that somebody presents credentials. Okay. So the protection story for credentials here is your credentials get fabricated at login, and the process is better not hand them out to the wrong parties. And the fly in that ointment is wrong parties includes servers, but you can't get anything done without handing them out to those. So in fact, what you have here is an approximation to an access control system, all of whose actual protection actually rests on capabilities, namely the assumption that this descriptor won't get handed out to the wrong party. Now, if you're prepared to believe that your processes can get that right, and there is reason to question it, but if you're prepared to believe that, why pass these extra arguments? Why not just use capabilities in the first place? Because that's actually what you did here. And a reasonable answer might be, hey, because I have a legacy API to support, and I just had to deal with it.
Right.
But this is not an architecturally motivated decision. It's a politically motivated decision. It's a sound. I mean, there are real good market reasons to deal with backwards compatibility. I'm not denigrating that. I'm just saying, don't be fooled by the little man behind the curtain. Right? There's no great wondrous Oz in this story. If you haven't read Frank Baum's books, you need to. Or more to the point, you will when you have kids, so there's no rush. Okay, so we could do the credentials and file number thing, but all we're really doing here is pushing the problem back one level to reducing it to a previously unsolved problem, which is the assumption that the application will manage its credentials properly. And if it was prepared to do that, then this model works. Now why, stepping back from the, was there actually a change in model, but there is one advantage to this. The one advantage to this is that it becomes much easier for multiple processes to share the same credentials. And there are times when you do not want to distinguish between processes. You want to say, hey, I want to start 5 different programs, but I want them all to act as me. And I really want them all to have exactly the same credentials. And our NSA representative is now trying to discuss, I hope. But yeah, there are times when users at least want to do that. Another thing that's nice about this, and it's an improvement over classical access control, is these credentials are first class. So one of the problems in access control systems is the total set of credentials in the system, in practice, tends to be the set recorded in the password file static. And often, I would like to start up a sub-process that does not run with all of my authority, but I would like it to run with some of my authority. And that implies creating a dynamic set of credentials. And that turns out to be very hard to do in an access control system. And the reason it's hard to do is because in order for that, in a POSIX system, the way I would do that, I would fabricate a temporary user ID. And then I would run around all the objects, and I would add the appropriate entries to their access control lists associated with that user ID. The problem is that by the time I'm done running around all these objects, it would have been, the any efficiency story for this is lost, and it became impractical. Okay, what I want to observe here is Windows did not gain any security in this move. It gained compatibility. That's not a bad thing. But it also did not gain any performance in this move because this model is achievable in the base capability model. You don't need credential support at the microkernel level. You want to do this protocol, you can do it on a generic capability system. And what this mostly shows is
If you have a generic capability system, you can do access control with this, and you can do it with as much or as little efficiency as Windows NT is currently doing it, and pretty obviously the customers think that's okay. I'm not sure I agree with them, but it's quite the path. What we did not do is actually build an access controller system, because in an access controller system, there's a problem between what's written in the literature and what's actually implemented. So what's written in the literature is we're trying to make an access decision based on whether the subject is authorized. If you go dig into the literature, you'll see the term subject is supposed to refer to a process. Unfortunately, processes have no durable identity. When you pull the plug in most systems, the processes die. And the consequence is, you can put a process name in this access control list, but when you pull the plug, the corresponding process dies, and so this process name doesn't have any value when the system comes back. And so what real systems do instead is they say, I will approximate a subject. I'll create an equivalence class of subjects called users. And every process that runs on behalf of some user, where user means somebody who logged in, not a human. All the processes that run on behalf of that user will be assigned some identifier associated with the user. It's called a principal ID. And so real access control systems rely on principal IDs. Why? Because the principal ID has long-term durability. When you reboot the system, barring you lose your password file, which does happen once in the blue moon, but it's not a case you designed for. When you reboot your system, principal IDs still have meaning, and we can still do at least some kind of a filtering test. The problem is, I don't really want Internet Explorer running with all of my authority. Because Internet Explorer obeys code written by people I have really good reason not to trust. And the best part is it downloads new code almost every day written by people I don't trust. I spent some time down in a meeting Monday and Tuesday that was hosted by a whole bunch of people, but the sort of key organizer was Joe, I want to say Jarzembeck, but I think I'm mispronouncing his name, in NSA. And one of the things they're talking about in that meeting, in the introduction of that meeting, is that this is not hypothetical, right? There are people out there who are shipping viruses. These people are not dumb. They test their viruses against antivirus before they release them. That's how they know they work. Okay? And you go and clear out the viruses, okay? But guess what comes in behind the virus is a Trojan horse. Okay? So after you clear out the virus, what's still out there is this piece of zombie code. And there's actually a market for those things. You can now get $1 per machine per week in certain parts of the world per zombie. And it turns out, not hard to generate $1 million in revenue this way. I don't recommend getting caught doing it. In fact, I don't recommend doing it, but I definitely don't recommend getting caught. So, there's some concrete evidence that principal IDs is just not good enough. What I'm trying to walk you through is, and by the way, there's nothing microkernel specific in this. Like, this is fundamentals of protection models. And what I'm trying to walk you through is, if we're going to try to look and ask, what's the right foundational protection mechanism to build into a microkernel? One of these can be built on the other efficiently. The reverse is not true. You can't efficiently build capabilities on top of access control lists. And flat doesn't work. Access control lists are just broken in the way that they're actually implemented. Now, we could change that, right? We could build a persistent system, and then subject IDs would have meaning again. And then the question would be, could we come up with a sensible story for updating the access lists? And I don't know. I'm suspicious that the answer pragmatically is no, but I haven't really looked at it yet. Certainly, we could come up with something like SE Linux, right, which tries to do classification-based compartmentalization after the fact. But if you actually look at what SE Linux is good at and what it's not good at, it's very good at certain things. It's very good if you have a statically expressible configuration in the system, and you can divide your system statically into sort of boxes, and you want to prohibit certain communications across the boxes, SE Linux is very, very good at that. And that was Steve Smalley's objective, and Pete Laskoka's objective in designing. But if you have a dynamic boundary that you have to protect against, then you can't statically pre-configure this. You have to control what individual processes can actually do on an individual basis. And SE Linux isn't designed to solve that problem. I have a lot of respect for SE Linux. I think it's about the best you can do pragmatically. Well, the set of tools it builds on, I'm not sure SE Linux in particular is the policy I want, but that approach is about the best I know how to do on a Unix-style system, and it really does help. We watch people try to break into our servers, and SE Linux really does get in their way. But it doesn't help the client side of the problem. It doesn't help the browser. You can't. And it therefore doesn't help the zombie problem, and the zombie problem is the denial of service problem. The reason servers are getting taken out is that I can go out for a buck a week, I can get 40,000 machines. Well, actually, for 40,000 machines. By the way, the price of that is falling. It was a buck a week 6 months ago, and according to the head of Sands, it was 45 cents last week. Okay, so just to wrap this up, let me now, having gone down this blind alley deliberately, so I'm going to propose, yes, the answer is we want to put the file number in the protected payload. The price of that is there's going to turn out to be a length limit on protected payload that's unfortunate, because it's shorter than we'd really like it to be. So in fact, what we're going to have to do is we are going to have to use multiple endpoints. But instead of doing one thread per file, we're going to do one thread for about 65,000 files, something like that. So now how are we going to marshal this message? Well, the protected payload comes out for free. That's part of the transport mechanism, is to deliver the protected payload. It has to be delivered by the kernel, because the whole point is we have to know it doesn't come from the client. So I'm going to assume that there's a dedicated slot that that comes into. And we can catch with that. I'll get that in 1 second. The offset and the length can be transmitted in registers. Now, registers here should be taken to mean either hardware registers or these extended registers that we're going to see on. And in fact, on the x86, we're going to have to use extended registers. It turns out there isn't really any compelling reason to ship the length separately. We already need a length in order to send the data string, and we can simply use that length because it's exactly the length we wanted here. So if we were going to rewrite this in some kind of interface definition language, what we would write it as is some 64-bit integer that describes the offset, and which syntax do I want to use? We were going to write this in Corba IDL. We basically say, well, we're going to send an N64 offset, and we're going to send a dynamically sized vector. And we'd actually put a limit here, because we actually do want a limit. So probably what we would do is we'd say, a vector of bytes up to 64K. But that star there means it's dynamically sized. So part of what we're going to get in the protocol is we're going to get a tip-off about how long the vector is. That's the length. And I make no excuses for this syntax. It really is as bad as it looks. And in fact, we don't use this in the Eros capability IDL, but this is how the Corbo idiots chose to. This is why the Corbo people should not be allowed to design syntax. Turns out they also should not be allowed to design runtime systems, but that's a discussion for another day. There is a catch with protected payload, and I want you to see it before we wrap up the protected payload discussion. And next week I'm going to start it on memory mapping. So the problem is, because of NIST, so if I have a client that invokes a server, and this client has some capability with some protected payload. Server 1, which is the uniquely invoked server, is going to get that protected payload along with the client-supplied message. Notice, by the way, the definition of message has changed here, because what comes out is not merely what goes in. And up to the introduction of protected payload, you could declare that what went out was what came in. There's some fuzz. You have to argue about the length field, right? You could argue that the length is sort of, if it's not explicitly provided, it is at least implicitly provided, because the client is sending so many bytes worth of stuff. Right? So the length, in some sense, was at least in that implicit sense part of the content sent by the client. The protected payload is not. Now, here's the catch. Because the payload changes in this transport, suppose this server wants to forward the request to some other server, or request some subsidiary service from some other server. Server 2, either server 1 and server 2 are in a totally agreed trust relationship, or we have to establish a different protected payload. The reason we have to establish a different protected payload is because when server 1 invokes server 2, we're going to get a second protected payload in the picture. And what server 2 is going to get is, right, if we were to just blindly forward the message, the second invocation is going to put its own protected payload into the picture. So server 2 is going to get PP prime, not the original PP. Server 1 can send the bits corresponding to the original PP, but those bits are not protected bits anymore. Server 2 cannot trust those bits unless it trusts server 1 with respect to whatever issue those bits were denoting, were capturing. And in the L4 system, there's a thing called deceiting, okay, which is that middle server can masquerade as the original call. There's no good answer to this. There are cases where you would really like to transparently forward. Deceiving is a disaster because it means the client again cannot control what the server is doing. And the server can masquerade as the client. But my observation in practice is that when you see this pattern, it almost always turns out that one of two things is true. Either server 1 and server 2 are in exactly the same trust domain, in which case they can believe each other's bits, and therefore server 2 can believe PP. Or server 2 is an unrelated trust domain, and think of server 1 as some kind of encapsulation of that. So server 2 has a relationship with server 1. That's PP prime. The client is completely unaware of that. And so what you have here is a nesting of relationships. And in the nesting case, it was exactly true that you wanted a different protected payload. In fact, in the nesting case, you're probably not even going to forward PP at all. Neither of these two cases requires deceiving. Right? And deceiving is another word for fraud. It's not something we want to build into our protection. It's a polite word for fraud. But there are occasionally cases where you really would like to do something different than this, and it just, there's no sound design in which you can avoid doing a fair bit of extra work. Okay, so I wanted you to see that. We'll start in on memory mapping next week, and I will also take questions on reading.